9:40. Alcohol will be sold from 9 a.m. till after midnight. BBC News.
This is BBC Radio 4. The Long View with Jonathan Friedland.
Officially, the statistics say this is a time of rising prosperity. The economic indicators are up. Except there's the stubborn problem of those who are persistently poor. Not because they can't get a job, but because the work they do doesn't pay enough to live on. That's certainly the picture today, with the majority of those in poverty now being in work. But it was also the story back in 1795, in the early years of Britain's Industrial Revolution. We've come to the Speen district of Newbury in West Berkshire, home of the Speenhamland system, one of the first attempts to deal with the challenge of the working poor, one that would have a wide and lasting impact. And we're standing here in the centre of town under the clock house, shielding from the rain, and some drilling work going on nearby. And just in front of us, surrounding the clock house, are some recently installed information panels telling the history of Speenhamland. And with me is Jeremy Seabrook, the author of Pauperland, a history of poverty and the poor in Britain. And Jeremy Seabrook, just sketch for us the picture with poverty in that period, the closing years of the 18th century.
Well, of course, the area around here would have been fields. In 1795, there was particular distress because there'd been two very bad harvests, because the war with France had prevented supplies from coming into the country. But there was also a longer-term impoverishment of the labourers, because enclosing landlords had been taking over common land on which people had been entitled to graze a cow, raise a few pigs or a few geese, and also to cut turf for fuel. So those economic advantages were being cut out of their lives, and they were being impoverished by that. And the Elizabethan Poor Laws, which had made allowance for the infirm and the elderly and the sick to be looked after, had also insisted that the able-bodied poor be set on work. And that was the part of the poor law that has never really worked effectively ever since the consolidation of the Elizabethan poor law in 1601. And that inability to apply that part of the poor law has come down the years since then, and we're still wrestling with it today.
But in this period, the 1790s, things are coming to a head. The old system, the Elizabethan poor laws, are fraying at the edges. They're failing, if you like. And on hand to give us a flavour of that is the actress Emerald O'Hanrahan, who will be well known to Radio 4 listeners for playing Emma Grundy in The Archers. And anyone who's been listening will have followed the storyline of Emma Grundy and Ed as they've been battling with rural working poverty. Channel the voice of Emma Grundy, if you would, for us, Emerald O'Hanrahan. How squeezed are you?
At its peak, we were going to food banks and not able to pay bills and eat as well and go to the shops. And me and my partner and two children are now living in my parents' house. It's quite squeezed, yeah.
But now going back to the 18th century, Emerald O'Hanrahan, what do you have there?
Well, this comes from an essay on the principle of population by the famous cleric Thomas Malthus, who was writing in the 1790s. To remedy the distresses of the common people, the poor laws of England have been instituted. But it is to be feared that though they may have alleviated a little the intensity of individual misfortune, they have spread the general evil over a much larger surface. I feel no doubt whatever that the parish laws of England have contributed to raise the price of provisions and to lower the real price of labour. They have therefore contributed to impoverish that class of people whose only possession is their labour. The labouring poor, to use a vulgar expression, always seem to live from hand to mouth.
So not a situation unlike Ed and Emma Grundy's actually there. And on hand here at the clock tower in Newbury, in what would have been then Speen, is Julia Unwin, who's the chief executive of the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, listening to that. And Julia Unwin, your foundation has been preeminent in advancing these figures that reveal that the working poor now are a majority of those who are in poverty.
Well, the majority of households that are in poverty have somebody who's working. They have somebody who's doing the decent thing and going out to work. and they are still unable to afford the essentials that Emma Grundy would say she needed and that most of us would think that people, however poor they are, should have. And our figures suggest that 1 in 8 of the population over a 2-year period will be unemployed for a time. So that group of people are going in and out of work. It's not surprising their household costs are really squeezed.
And back in the 18th century, we've said, Jeremy Seabrook, that 1795 is the year that things come to a head. What is it that people decided, people in charge, decided to do?
First of all, you have to remember that it was only a few years after the French Revolution, and there was tremendous unrest in the countryside. In fact, 1795 was a year of food riots. So the magistrates of Berkshire met in the parish of Speenhamland to consider what could be done to assist the labouring poor.
And as it happens, there is an information panel recently put up here at the Clockhouse telling us the story of then and mentioning the 6th of May 1795. Also on hand here by the clock tower is local historian Phil Wood. It's a big place, Berkshire. Why did the local magistrates decide to meet right here?
Well, Speenhamland, situated on the northern edge of Newbury, was a very convenient spot to meet because it's a crossroads. The turnpike roads east and west from London to Bath and Bristol passed through Speenhamland, as did the turnpikes up from Southampton, Winchester, up to Oxford and the Midlands beyond. And so the communications were very good. The JPs could get here easily. And they were coming from North Berkshire up almost as far as Oxford, from the Windsor area around Maidenhead.
And did they meet very often, or were they aware this was a very special meeting?
This was a special meeting of the Berkshire Quarter Sessions, the nearest thing you had to a county council of the day, who would adjudicate on legal matters generally, but at earlier legal quarter sessions they had called for a special meeting to discuss this critical issue.
And they were very clear on the aim of the meeting. They spelt it out in black and white. And Emerald O'Hanrahan, you have that.
Yes, I have a photocopy of the report of the Speenhamland meeting. The original's actually kept in the Berkshire Record Office. The cover reads, "Berkshire, to wit, a general meeting of the justices of this county, together with several discreet persons assembled by public advertisement, on Wednesday the 6th day of May, 1795, at the Pelican Inn in Speenhamland, in pursuance of an order of the Court of General Quarter Sessions for the purpose of rating husbandry wages by the day or week, if then approved of."
So the aim of the meeting is very clear, for the purpose of rating husbandry wages. The magistrates gathering here want to set a kind of living wage. How do they get on? Let's go inside what would have been the Pelican Inn and find out. That's the stable yard. That's where, back in when those magistrates were meeting in 1795, they'd have had horses stable there. Well, we've crossed the road to what would have been the Pelican Inn, now a porticoed entrance, had a local estate agent. And Phil were telling me that this place redolent with history to the extent that the very first mobile phone call was made from this place back in 1985. But now it is, and we're going inside here to the boardroom of a local estate agent.
Jackson Stubbs, good afternoon.
And perhaps it was in a room like this when this place was the Pelican Inn that our local worthies, burghers, these magistrates of Berkshire would have gathered together, perhaps around a wooden table like this one, to debate how best to deal with the problem of the working poor, the labouring poor. Emerald O'Hanrahan, you have a statement there of what the meeting actually achieved.
Yes, the Speenhamland Agreement signed at the meeting in May 1795 accepted it wasn't possible to set a minimum wage, but the magistrates very earnestly recommend to the farmers and others throughout the county to increase the pay of their labourers in proportion to the present price of provisions. And agreeable thereto, the magistrates now present have unanimously resolved that they will, in their several divisions, make the following calculations and allowances for the relief of all poor and industrious men and their families. That is to say, when the gallon loaf of second flour, weighing £8.11, shall come to 1 shilling, then every poor and industrious man shall have for his own support 3 shillings weekly, either produced by his own or his family's labour, or an allowance from the poor rates, and for the support of his wife and every other of his family, 1 shilling and 6 pence.
What's interesting, Jeremy Seabrook, and we heard it there in the reading, they go in there hoping just to call on farmers to increase pay, and by the end they're talking almost as if they recognise farmers are not going to do that. They're talking about topping up and making sure they've got enough bread to eat. What's happened there?
Well, the idea was very much in the air in the 1790s. In fact, in 1795, Samuel Whitbread in Parliament had introduced a minimum wages bill, which was lost because Pitt, the Prime Minister, said he would introduce a poor bill, which he didn't because the landed interests finally defeated it. But the general feeling in the air was that the people had to be given a wage that enabled them to survive. The right to life was enshrined in the Speenham land system.
I remember even from my own O-level history having heard of Speenham, and it suggests that this was not just confined to this one part of Berkshire, for that name to have lived on, even to have reached the textbooks I read some time ago.
No, it spread very fast. In fact, somewhere they said it had spread like a fever through the southern counties of England. It didn't reach the north because the north was already industrialising and was the beginning of the two nations, north and south. So there were lots of variations on the Speenham land system, and it wasn't a single bread scale that it was that it sometimes represented.
Listening to that here in what would have been the Pelican Inn is Dr. Stephen Davis of the free market think tank, the Institute of Economic Affairs. And I suspect, Stephen Davis, you hear about this, these local worthies gathering around, trying to make sure that wages are enough, right down to the last grain of flour almost. You and your colleagues at the Institute of Economic Affairs would say that's meddling in the free market.
Well, basically, it's an attempt to achieve the impossible, is what I would say. The fundamental problem is that the agricultural labourers in this part of England are simply not productive enough to earn a high enough wage to live on, and that's a social problem that the magistrates are trying to deal with. And their solution is to deal with it by topping up their wages so that they can afford a decent standard of living. But ultimately, that actually creates more problems than it solves, then and now. And the result, amongst other things, is to create widespread hostility to the poor amongst the tax-paying population, and also to trap a very large number of the rural poor at that time in a condition of chronic poverty, just as it's done the same today.
So let's put that to you, Julia Unwin, from the Joseph Rowntree Foundation. It's not that the employers are not paying enough, it's that the workers aren't productive enough.
Well, the magistrates were faced with the problem and the choice that we've had for centuries since. Either they insist on the wages being higher, and they weren't productive enough to provide for that, or they subsidise it. Otherwise, they deal with widespread destitution with all the risks that that brings to society. That's a very difficult choice for any group of magistrates, as it is for government today. Were they productive enough? We've heard that the income was going into the farmers, there was more income coming out of the land. It wasn't being distributed to the workers in the way that allowed them to maintain their families.
To put this to you, Emerald O'Hanrahan, you've been playing Emma Grundy. This sort of calculation, having to work out the pennies for them to make sure there's enough food, is that what the Grundys are going through?
That's exactly what Emma was doing about a year ago when it was at its worst, was making decisions on what to spend the money on, to pay the bills that are overdue, or to buy bread, or to miss meals herself, which is what happened. And they're both working. Emma was working as a cleaner as well as looking after her two children, and Ed is obviously a farmer.
And you would be, Julia Unwin, the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, finding evidence of this. Both people working and literally can't eat.
Considerable evidence. And we reported in December that there are more people living in households where somebody is working who are now living in poverty. People are making really tough choices about feeding themselves, heating their houses, looking after their children. Difficult choices being made.
That's the picture now. What about back then, Jeremy Seabrook, the men who gathered here, and they would have all been men, they set up this system, the Speenham system, variants of that around the country. How did it work out?
Well, it worked out rather disastrously over the long term because labourers knew they were going to get their wages whatever they did. They didn't work particularly hard. And because farmers knew that the wages were going to be topped up by the parish, they lowered wages. So there was a kind of general demoralisation of the whole countryside was the real issue after this had been working for some time.
For an account of how poverty does persist, even after measures like Speenham land, Emerald O'Hanrahan, you have that.
Yes, this is from William Cobbett's Rural Rides, published in 1820, in which he talks in detail about the impact of systems like the Speenham land one and their impact on rural communities. Why do farmers not feed and lodge their workpeople as they did formerly? Because they cannot keep them upon so little as they give them in wages. Judge then of the change that has taken place in the condition of these labourers, and be astonished, if you can, at the pauperism and crimes that now disgrace this once happy and moral England.
So pauperism disgracing the land of England, there's a sense that poverty is not just persisting, but in some cases getting worse. Something else must be done after the Spinnenland effort. What will that be? That's what we're going to find out next. We're taking the long view of the working poor and telling the story of the Spinnenland system of 1795. We have wandered across Newbury into one of the buildings of the West Berkshire Museum, arrayed before us some exhibits from this place, including a wonderful and colour line drawing of the boundary between Spinnenland and the rest of Newbury. And Jeremy Seabrook there, a drawing of Spinnenland as it would have been in the early part of the 18th century, just a reminder how rural this area was.
We're looking at the site of labour of the majority of people employed, which are agricultural labourers.
We know that the Spinnenland system didn't succeed. What was their next move?
The next move was to set up a commission which would look into the workings of the poor law and come up with suitable recommendations.
And did they approach that task with a sort of blank slate, if you like, an open mind, or did they already have a pretty good idea of where they were heading?
They knew very well where they were heading, because we must remember this is the time in which the ideology of political economy was also being forged. People believed that they discovered the laws of society, and that it was actually, the economy was a kind of force of nature, a natural phenomenon, and that as long as government stayed out of it, it would work and come into balance between supply and demand quite happily. And government interference was the great bugbear. And this informs all of the deliberations of the Poor Law Commission, and it influenced everything they wrote.
Emerald Hanrahan, you have something there of their findings.
The paupers are discontented from their expectations being raised by the ordinary administration of the system, beyond any means of satisfying them. They, as well as the independent labourers, to whom the term poor is equally applied, are instructed that they have a right to a reasonable subsistence, or fair subsistence, or an adequate subsistence. When I've asked of the rate distributor what fair or reasonable or adequate meant, I have in every instance been answered differently, some stating that they thought it meant such as would give a good allowance of meat every day, which no poor man, meaning a pauper, should be without, although a large proportion of the rate payers go without it.
So that statement there from the commissioners on the poor law, Steve Davies, there are similar arguments raging on exactly those lines now.
Very much so. And the same kind of feelings of irritation and exasperation that are expressed in that text there are widespread amongst taxpaying members of the public today, people who are often actually on lower incomes, effectively, than people who receive benefit, who strongly resent the fact that they're being taxed in order to subsidise other people. Now, you may not blame the people who are getting the benefit, but undoubtedly this causes a lot of bad feeling.
Julia Unwin?
Very many people are on benefits for times of their lives and off benefits. Even people on benefits are paying tax at some level or another. There is resentment, it's undoubtedly true, but actually the real issue is how do people without enough to live on get supported, whether they're working or not?
Nevertheless, those commissioners back then in the 19th century are complaining of this inconsistency, as they reported. Jeremy Seabrook, what action did they decide to take to end this confusion, if you like?
The Poor Law Commission reported in 1834, and it was immediately enacted, which showed that it was a kind of foregone conclusion. The Poor Law Amendment Act of 1834 embodied all the kind of punitive functions that the bureaucracy could imagine. They introduced the workhouse, first of all, and the workhouse test, which introduces the law of less eligibility, which says any able-bodied person who wishes to take refuge in the workhouse must accept that he or she will be worse off inside the workhouse than the worst-off labourer outside, independent labourer. Outrelief is abolished, and that's the significant thing of 1834, so that you can no longer stay at home and get what would now be called benefits.
And indeed here, this display held by West Berkshire Museum records there was a union workhouse in this area. We've got even a drawing, if you like, almost the plan, showing the panopticon in the middle and the courtyards and a photograph of those buildings. And it does very much look actually like a prison building with a courtyard for the men and a courtyard for the women. So the workhouse came here. Steve Davies, it was, no one suggesting the Institute of Economic Affairs wants to go back to the workhouse with all the Dickensian baggage that term carries, but it was a radical solution to essentially say there is no option of continuing poor and getting a handout. Are you thinking, and people like you, thinking of similarly radical ideas for today's working poor?
We certainly need to do something radical, because the basic fact now, as it was, as we heard in 1832, is that the existing system is not working, is incredibly expensive, and is actually ultimately harming the interests of the people who are receiving the benefits, the poor. So we do need to do radical things. In the longer term, we need to raise the productivity of the workforce so that people will actually earn more. In the short term, the key thing to do is, firstly, to make work more attractive than being on benefits. In other words, to restore the less eligibility principle, if you will. And secondly, to reduce the cost of living, because a major part of the problem, as we heard earlier, is that the cost of living for the poor has been rising more rapidly than for any other group in society.
Now, our story began in 1795 when the Newbury MP, Charles Dundas, brought together those local magistrates who sat at the Pelican Inn, drawing up the system that would become known as the Speenhamland system. His successor, many generations down at the ages, is the Member of Parliament for Newbury today, Richard Bennion, and he's also here looking at these drawings of his constituency in times past. Richard Bennion, this argument, you're a Member of Parliament for the Conservatives, the Coalition is grappling with this issue of the working poor. In the end, we've just heard, it was a pretty radical solution that came out of Speenhamland's failure, the workhouse. How radical is your government prepared to be, and is it being, about dealing with the problem of working poverty?
I think what's fascinating about Speenhamland is a debate that's happening in my party at the moment about the minimum wage. I think that the Speenhamland system was done through very good motives of wanting to help the abject poor, as we referred to them at that time. And today, in a similar way, we're seeing how that system increasingly failed, and bad employers were actually using it to supplement wages.
So you mean Gordon Brown's system of tax credits?
Of tax credits.
That was the Speenhamland of its day, was it?
It's become that, rather because he threw so much at it. And actually, the debate in the Conservative Party about whether we should increase the minimum wage, and quite a lot of us think we should, is precisely to deal with the similar sort of problems that were being faced by the failings of the Speenhamland system all those years ago.
So a minimum wage, Steve Davis, what's wrong with that?
The danger is that it will tend to lead to less employment. Not necessarily across the board, but for certain vulnerable groups, particularly young people and the unskilled, who are the major problematic group amongst the workforce. I think that the answer in the short term is to make low pay go further. And the key thing here is to do things that will reduce the cost of living by bringing down the cost of essentials, things like housing, power, food, childcare. But particularly housing, because as we heard in the early readings, essentially what the magistrates here were doing was supplementing people's wages so they could buy bread. What we're now doing, at an immense cost, I might add, is to supplement people's wages so that they can pay for housing. And this is entirely due to government policy and particularly the planning laws, which means we simply are not providing enough housing supply. And that's quite easily dealt with.
So Richard Bennion, the way you could help the working poor, not supplementing their wages, but making things more affordable. Important things like housing.
Really important things like that, and freezing council tax and looking at the whole of households' collective bills. And that's what the government is doing and should be doing as we move forward.
Julia Unwin.
I would share the views of everybody around this table that the current system is not a successful one and it doesn't help people out of work. But the one thing we mustn't think is that it is not in itself punitive. People are leading very, very hard lives if they live on benefits and are not able to make the normal steps back into work, back into education, that we desperately need them to make. For that reason, it's hugely wasteful.
Richard Bennion, what about that? You know, the climate of opinion at the moment, Benefit Street, the programme on TV, the idea that you can live the life of Riley on benefits. What does your government say to that?
Nobody should pretend that our system is fantastically generous. There are people who find life extremely difficult, even in a relatively well-off area such as this. In fact, it's tougher to be poor, to be on a low income and living in a place like Newbury than it is in an area where there are high levels of deprivation, because the system throws much more resources at those areas than it does here. The work of this government, of any government, must be to get more people into work, and that means making sure businesses find it easy to employ them.
Except though, Julia Unwin, that might not be enough of an answer. They could get in work, but they're doing part-time work on low wages, and it's not enough.
People need to get into work which sustains them for the long term. There is work to be had, which is short-term, which is seasonal, that comes and goes. And most people, exactly as Richard says, are desperate for those jobs, and they take them. The poor law commissioners who assumed that nobody would look for work were wrong. People do look for work, and they continue to look for work. Unless they get work that they can keep, and that maintains them, we are going to carry on facing this precise problem about the levels of working people who are living in poverty.
And do you detect this sort of disapproval of the poor, whether working or not that fueled, and we're looking at the drawings and photographs of the old workhouse. No one's bringing that back now, but is there an attitude of disdain for those people who are poor and struggling?
I think there's a discussion and a debate about people in poverty, the like of which I haven't heard in all my working life. People are talked about as if they are an inferior species, as if they are a group who have no interest in joining in the rest of society. And yet all the evidence is that many of us could be poor, have been poor, and know people who are poor. It is a condition. It doesn't describe an individual.
Steve Davis, Julia Unwin of the Roundtree Foundation, saying she's never heard this harsh, disparaging language applied to people who are poor.
Well, it's certainly happening at the moment, and it's a recurrence, actually, of the kind of language that we got in the 1820s and 1830s. From the economist's point of view, people on benefits who don't take higher-paid jobs or don't work are behaving perfectly rationally, because the incentives they face are that it's hardly worth working, because they will lose virtually all of the gains that they would make from working. So what we need to do is to actually return dignity. It's worth pointing out that what the commissioners wanted was not only to make welfare punitive, they also wanted to restore the dignity of the working poor, so that they would become and see themselves as being respectable, productive members of society, and that's what we need to return to.
Richard Bennion.
If Ian Duncan Smith was here now, he would say that what he is trying to do is to bring some dignity back into people's lives, and the indignity that I as an MP find when people come into my surgeries and say, actually, they're better off out of work. It's not making them feel proud. It makes them very resentful of the system. And his attempts to try and turn that around have got to be right.
But after Spinnenland, the feeling was that we must make receiving state assistance a last resort. So much of a last resort, it'll be going to the workhouse. But is your government now similarly trying to make the receipt of benefits and state assistance a last resort?
It's trying to make it fair both for the people who pay for it, and every household pays about £3,000 a year into the welfare state, and it's fair for the person, and the encouragement must be and the support must be to get them into work. And trying to get that balance right will be an eternal struggle of governments past and future. Of course, we don't want to go back to the kind of demonisation that existed at the time that these pictures in front of us were drawn.
Jeremy Seabrook, we're looking at this fine colour line drawing of Spinnenland and the boundary with Newbury. The people who gathered there were full of good intention at that Pelican Inn, set up this system which you described as disastrous. Did they really achieve nothing?
No, they didn't achieve nothing, because in spite of all its defects, I mean, Spinnenland did not work, and it did lead to a certain amount of demoralisation. But on the other hand, it probably saved a certain number of people and quite a large number of agricultural labourers from starvation. And that is not, after all, a mean achievement.
Jeremy Seabrook, Steve Davis, Julia Unwin, Member of Parliament Richard Bennion, and earlier Phil Wood, and our actress Emerald O'Hanrahan. From here, with the West Berkshire Museum collection laid before us, including its views of Spinnenland past, thank you all for taking The Long View.
The Long View is presented by Jonathan Friedland. The producer is Tom Auburn.